Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we'll be discussing Niger's severed military ties with the United States. I am joined by a special guest, Fidel Amake Owusu. Fidel is a distinguished international relations and security analyst from Ghana. And he's the CEO of DefSec Analytics Africa Limited. He's also a senior conflict analyst at the Conflict Research Consortium for Africa. Fidel, I've been following your writings, especially with this topic on LinkedIn, and a lot of your colleagues as well have a ton of respect for your opinion and views. So I'm very delighted to have you join me today. And I look forward to our conversation.
The pleasure is mine, and I'm humbled by your kind words.
Yeah, you're welcome. So let me just start off. So in the recent days, we've seen the military government of Niger cut military ties, its agreement, military agreement with the United States. Before we get into all of that, the nitty-gritty of the matter, can you tell us or begin with, what is this agreement in the first place? Why did they have the agreement in the first place? What is the scope of the agreement?
Thank you very much for this opportunity, Doc. I see this as a great privilege to be here and to speak to my fellow continental colleagues and citizens across Africa. Firstly, as a security analyst, we are more brutal with the truth or the facts, because then we do not toe ideological lines or any dogmatic lines. We see it as it is and then make sure that the analysis are done for the consumption of all. And so the consumer is given that kind of liberty to actually decide for him or herself what the dynamics may lead to and how they may relate to him or her. That said, I would say that for any foreign power or any foreign country or country to establish a base in another country, the home country must accept it before it is done. You cannot come all the way from wherever you are coming from to establish a base in another man's country without that man's consent or without the consent of the host country. And that is how international affairs and international relations is regulated. And so in the case of the United States having a base in Niger, it went through that process where back in 2011, 2012, when Al-Qaeda and other rebellions started in the Sahel, and Al-Qaeda was threatening to overrun many of these countries, especially Mali and Niger. And in the case of Mali, actually Timbuktu and other important towns were taken by this jihadist. And so it became necessary for the global community to intervene. And at a time, we all know how France has dominated its former colonies even after independence, and which has been very unfair. And we have trumpeted this from time to time. However, the case was that France actually intervened in the situation, and then ECOWAS also intervened. And the combination of these efforts led to the beating back or the prevention of the jihadis running over important territories or cities and towns in the Sahel. So at the time, the US also thought that it needed a base in the Sahel in order for surveillance and for targeting purposes to strike Al-Qaeda jihadists and for surveillance purposes. And this has been part of the US counterterrorism effort, where after 9/11, US focused on states it had labeled safe havens. It means any weak state which weakness allowed terrorism to fester was supposed to be engaged with or cooperated with in order for the US to have some presence or some support to stop terrorism from, or to stop terrorists to having a breeding ground, which may in the long term lead to US being hit on its soil or its targets being hit in the region. So that has been part of the US counterterrorism policy. And the establishment of that base in Niger at the time was in line with that policy. However, maybe subsequent questions may come up with some of these current dynamics. So basically, that was what brought about the base. And so some $100 million was invested in that and to establish the base in order have this purpose. And the base was specifically a drone base. So a number of drones are operated by the US military in order to achieve this counterterrorism purpose.
Okay. Well, when you say a base, what is the scope of this occupation? You know, we know it could be in terms of numbers, in terms of like how many troops do they have, how many bases do they have in Niger itself? Is it just a base? I heard you say a base. Is it just one base, or is it several bases in that country?
Yeah, so for what we know formally, it's supposed to be a single base. And in fact, in terms of numbers, we know that at least some 1,000 US forces are stationed there. Because 1,000, when you look at the vastness of Niger, Niger is the largest country in West Africa, or the ECOWAS West Africa, so to speak. And so 1,000 soldiers, what is the significance of it? And as I have mentioned, they are operating drones. They are not into face-to-face combat missions. They are operating drones. And if the need for personnel is that sometimes drones may malfunction and you need somebody to retrieve it and other operations that may be necessary. And so formally, it's supposed to be one base, one known base. However, when these things happen and the state is in that comfortable relations with the host state, it leads to other auxiliary facilities created in order to make the operations flexible. So if I hear that the base has gone beyond one main one that we know, then I think that should be the case. However, the most important thing is that was established for counterterrorism purpose, for which the Nigerian military was also fighting. And as the conversation goes on, I think other dynamics may come up. Yeah.
Okay. So I guess the next logical question would be, why did Niger cut ties with the United States at this point?
Thank you very much for this question. In fact, this question is a complex one. The complexity is not for lack of analysis to it, but it's because of the entrenched position that currently Africa faces. We are in the midst of great power competition. And just like the Cold War, when Africa was a turf for Cold War politics, the ideological clash between the United States and the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics, USSR, and which Africa became a tough, and proxy wars were waged in Africa that devastated a lot of political systems, overthrew some great leaders like Haile Selassie and Kwame Nkrumah and other leaders, which led to very acrimonious coup d'etats that have divided some countries to this day, especially the DRC and things like that. Now we are seeing a resurgence of such great power politics in Africa. And the players now are not in a bipolar world where we had the USSR and the US. Currently, we have a multipolar struggle, which involves the United States, Russia, China, and even emerging powers, also known as middle powers, Turkey, Israel, the Gulf states, and all other powers like Brazil, India, are also playing roles in this power struggle, all struggling over resources in Africa, and those in Niger are not an exception to this. Now, the question was, why did the junta terminate this agreement? When the coup happened last year, clearly the coup had the support of Russia. Not that Russia had directly instigated it, but after the coup, all communication coming from Moscow proved that Russia backed the coup makers. And when ECOWAS sanctioned, I mean, it became a cause celebre in the region where ECOWAS sanctions were condemned by some, and some also thought that, well, since it's in the protocol, it is good to sanction, because any organization without a sanction regime is no organization. Any, I mean, from our days in school, whenever you went out of the law, you were punished. And being part of or being a member of a regional organization is no exception. There are regimes that will punish you or sanction you when you go outside the line. And per the ECOWAS protocol, the use of force to take over government is punishable, or it comes with sanctions. And so those sanctions were unleashed, but people thought that they were so harsh. And again, other coup states like Burkina Faso and Niger and Mali were willing or openly declared that they were going to support Niger against any ECOWAS intervention that was supposed to be part of a sanction regime against Niamey. Mm-hmm. All that said, ECOWAS has had a backpedal. It has retreated. The president of Nigeria has asked that these sanctions are removed so that goods and services could reach Niamey and or Niger in general. Mm-hmm. Now, from the word go, the US had played such an ambivalent role in that the US did not see the coup makers' antagonism towards France as an extension to itself. This is to say that when the coup makers asked France to leave the country, French forces to leave the country and cutting ties with France, US thought that, well, we have never been colonizers in West Africa. So we are different from France. Despite the fact that we are all seen as Western countries, we are all NATO members, the coup makers are going to treat us differently, because we are here for different purposes. Mm-hmm. Now, some of us have urged some caution on that, because then the situation is unpredictable. So in the recent days, the US delegation were in Niamey to renegotiate or to negotiate further stay of US forces in Niger. And from what we heard, these ties, the Nigerians or the junta in Niger are not interested in any further cooperation, military cooperation with the United States. They have given reasons, but maybe those are follow-up questions from you. But at the end of the day, they are saying that they don't want to be part of this deal. And maybe I'll go straight to say that some of the things they had raised were that, one, the US is condescending. And the word condescending means when someone is looking down on you. I mean, someone doesn't see you as an equal. Someone is trying to tell you what is right against your will. And it's a broad word. And that's how the junta labeled the United States. Again, they also said that the US had breached protocol. That is the number of delegation that was the numbers in the delegation that was expected in Niamey actually was above what was expected. I mean, there were some members that they were not expecting, but they found them in, and they thought that that was disrespectful. And so that was also mentioned. Again, they also said that they wanted a partner who will truly fight terrorism. That is also something that the junta raised. And obviously, they are talking about Russia. And these are the things, the concerns they raised. So they had generally seen the relationship with US as no more relevant or inconsequential, and so they would like to terminate it. Thank you, sir.
Bella, you predicted my the next question I was going to ask you. I think you've answered it, but I don't know if there's any room to add to, but I think you've predicted it, because we saw in the wake of the junta seizing power, the bulk of the anger was directed towards France, and you know, the France flag was being burnt, France was asked to leave, and you know, US was spared. And I was going to ask you, why was US spared at that time? But I think you've answered that question, unless you want to expand on it. But I think you've answered it. Okay, go on.
Yeah, so I'll add that there is something about the military regimes, especially in the 21st century. Many of them are aware of what happened in Africa in the 70s and the 80s. What happened? We had so many coups. In fact, Togo was the first country in sub-Saharan Africa to experience a coup. 1963, Togo. Then we had Nigeria. Then we had Ghana. Then there were chains of coup. In Sierra Leone, they were having many of them within a year or so. And counter coups, both successful and unsuccessful. These new soldiers have learned that. And they have learned how to stay on. And so when the issue of France came, they could not put US together with France, or they could not put the two in the same basket. Because then it will be like, well, then you are not talking about neocolonialism. You are just against Western interests. So they started with France. And I think that is where US might have overlooked or might have underestimated what could happen in the long term. Because then they said, well, we are not colonizers. If these guys are going to cooperate with us, we are going to also cooperate with them in order to stay on and achieve our security goal of not making Niger a terror haven or safe haven for terrorists. So that could have been another, apart from the colonial and the other issues that I have raised. Thank you.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, so you've mentioned so many things there. I'll come to the great power competition. I will come to some of the key ECOWAS and all of that in a minute. But what is the cost of this severance? This severing of what is the cost? One,
okay,
to Niger. What is the cost to the United States? What is the cost to an extension to the EU? And what is the cost to the region, the Sahel and West Africa region, in terms of security?
Yeah, so earlier I had an interview that is about a couple of days ago with a Nigerian portal, and I think that was yesterday. And I had mentioned that Nigerian news agency, and I had mentioned that these kind of actions are two-edged swords, they cut on both sides. One, US invests $100 million in a drone base and maybe other auxiliary facilities, as you had, asked earlier. And then all of a sudden, they are supposed to leave. Hmm. I mean, it's not all of a sudden. They've stayed there for some time. But then this was quite unexpected if you look at the bigger picture. And then they are supposed to leave. It means that, not much profit has been made. I mean, it was not built for profit purposes, but then it's for security purposes, and such purposes are long-term. They are planning a long-term, but it comes to an end. So definitely something is lost strategically, tactically, operationally, and in resource. So something is lost. Then you move on to the Nigerian side. Now, it is a serious gamble. Where is the gamble here? Now, the whole thing is that you are doing away with one of the great powers that are struggling in the continent. I remember in the 50s. The first prime minister and president of Ghana, Nkrumah, was very smart in playing this game. He saw that, well, the Soviet Union was interested in Ghana, and the United States was also interested, or the West was also interested. So what Nkrumah did was to tell them that, look, Ghana is not looking left, it's not looking right, it's looking forward. And by that, what he did was to engage both Washington and the Kremlin, or Moscow, in achieving his goals, socioeconomic goals. What he did was this. He went to the United States and secured a loan to build, at the time, the largest dam on the continent. And then he also secured a loan with the United States to build the Tema Harbor. That is one of the largest harbors in West Africa. And build a community, a whole city, mini city, around the harbor. And then an aluminum smelter. Baku, and which is still around. And then he moved to Moscow and secured the Black Star Line, a shipping line for Ghana. And so at the time, Ghana had its own shipping line, which has since collapsed. And it means that in trading, we had our own ships. So he was able to capitalize on the struggle to gain from both sides. So when you entirely cut ties with one group, then it means that you have really drawn the line that, well, I am not going with these guys. But there is a caveat. Why would they take such a decision? It is simple. Currently, the junta in the Sahel do not want to hear anything democracy. And it's so clear. Anybody who tells them to hand over is somebody who is, to them, engaging in some form of aggression. And so, things they don't want to hand over, they don't want anybody who sits around the table with them and say, well, based on our principle, we like democracy, and therefore we would urge that in the long term or in the short term, power should be handed over, there should be democratic transition. No, that is not going to be bought by the junta. And that is not only in Niger, we see that in Burkina Faso, and we see it in Mali. And so, by cutting ties with the West, it means that, I mean, Moscow is never going to tell you to hand over. No, no, no. Putin is not going to do that. As long as they have some resources like Wagner, Wagner comes in, says, well, I'll give you regime protection. I will give you, I'll fight terrorism. But what I need is resources in their raw form. And these are deals that Wagner has cut across Africa. And so that's all they care about, whether whoever is in power is a dictator, is an autocrat, is a military junta, is whoever that he is, or an oligarch. They do not care about that. And according to the junta, they see that as respectful, because then it means the person is not trying to interfere in their domestic issues, as long as the person endorses whatever they are doing. So this is the nature of the cost involved. The cost, so far, in terms of the leadership itself, in Niamey, they are not going to incur any cost, the leadership. I mean, as long as they have the guns to stay on, they are going to stay on. But then the Nigerian economy has been also linked to the Western world, as well as other regions like China and Russia and other places. They have been linked to the Western world. And so with this attitude, if the West is retaliates, how is it going to work? I mean, use the spare parts, other things. What have been the vehicles that are running in the streets of Niamey? Are they the Renaults and the Peugeots and all that? So these are the questions you have to ask. And if there are parts, where is it going to come from? Is it from Nigeria? Is it going to come from the West? And these are some of the things that the challenges that they could face in the short term. But over time, perhaps they may supplant that with other powers like Russia, Iran, and others, because already we have seen Iran holding talks with a junta. Russia is already holding talk. Turkey is also interested in the region.
Yeah, brilliant. You mentioned something during the Cold War. During the Cold War, is the issue of agency. During the Cold War, where we had clearly a bipolar world, where African authoritarian governments played, let's say, played both sides. And we're able to gain some leverage in terms of many African countries were kind of like towards them, the non-alignment, non-aligned states, you know, not aligning to any of the superpowers. And they were able to see even the Western countries themselves, you know, supporting authoritarian governments or propping them up for their own. Does the same thing we're talking about now. So if we now come to the new reality where we have multiple powers, and then we see the Niger example and see how is Niger and the other military government like Burkina Faso and Mali, how are they leveraging these dynamics to their own advantage? But I guess the question I was going to ask before I come to the other question is, are you in any way sympathetic? Do you think it's just simply a strategy by the Kunta government to then play on the narrative, the neo-colonial narrative, the anti-Western narrative? Or is there some element of truth in it? Because we've just done a Russian episode, and some of the comments, people are saying, oh, you need to, I'm speaking to people in Washington, I need to speak to people in the continent, that, you know, Russia did that. So, okay, I'll bring some African, you know, people like us to come and speak and let's see. So if we're talking about democracy, do you think the Kunta government has the right to say, you can't teach us democracy? Because we've seen a lot of democratic backsliding, even in the West itself. We see what's going on with Israel and, you know, in Gaza and, you know, in other places. So do you think we can put the blame solely on the Kunta? Or do you think the West itself provides that opportunity for the Kunta? Do you think they have, do you think there's credibility, is what I'm trying to say? Do you think there's some credibility in their decisions and actions?
All right. Thank you so much. This is a very important question. Consistently, I have written that post-colonial French policy in West Africa and Africa in general was backward, defeatist, and exploitative. And I have said that, look, if you look at Francophone countries and their constitutions, you will see that it is a clear photocopy of the 1958 Constitution of France. That is the Fifth Republican Constitution, when Charles de Gaulle decided to write a constitution that gave him unlimited power, almost unlimited power in France. Because at the time, the Fourth Republican Constitution of France was so weak that in 2 weeks, you could have three prime ministers in 2 weeks because it was so unstable. And so Charles de Gaulle stepped in and created an imperial presidency. And sadly for Africa, it was that at that time that France decided to grant independence to its colonies. And so African leaders at the time, the independence leaders in Francophone Africa, swallowed these constitutions hook, line, sinker, and copied it. Term of office, 7 years, they also copied it. A president, an executive president with a prime minister who was a puppet, was also copied. They made sure that there was no term limit. Charles de Gaulle didn't have term limit. Francophone countries, they didn't have term limit. So you look at this and realize that France did not help its colonies right from the scratch. So whatever that is unraveling or unfolding currently, it's as a result of that tendency to still hold on to your former colonies when you are supposed to leave them to take their own path. Look, the Anglophone Britain still had influence in its colonies or former colonies, but it is not as repugnant and as so much, as protective like that of France. So that is a recipe, that was a recipe for disaster, and we are seeing the disaster. However, the junta, what is their interest? Their interest is to stay. And that is something that many people don't want to accept, that the junta are not interested in democracy. What will democracy do for them? It will mean handing over power, and they don't want that. So despite the exploitation that has ended, and you see, there is something interesting, and we have already started seeing it in Mali. France was the factor to blame, and in the case of France, it was justified. So Mali, Burkina Faso asked France to leave. France has left these two countries. So then the people ask, now France has left. What happens to us? Are we safe? Are we satisfied? Is development there? Are we secure? Then you realize that you are still not secure. Then the issue of terrorism comes in. That during the coup, they said, because of insecurity, that's why we are taking power. You take power, and the insecurity situation is worse than it used to be. And then the people ask, so why did you take power? So that is also gone. Then ECOWAS unleashed its sanctions, and ECOWAS becomes the point of blame. That, okay, the problem is, okay, France is gone. Insecurity we are managing, but the problem is ECOWAS. ECOWAS is sanctioning us, and that is why we are ineffective. Now ECOWAS removes sanctions. Who are you going to blame next? So this is in the books. This is in the playbooks that people use to manipulate citizens. It's there in the world over. Many leaders use it, and it is happening in West Africa. And we see the euphoria, the youth that never experienced the coups of the 70s and the 80s. Being euphoric and being nostalgic, and the word nostalgic is used metaphorically because they didn't experience it in the first place. So many people are excited because they did not know this. So now, with all these blame points being taken away, currently you cannot, if US leave Niger, you cannot mention US as being the cause of Niger's problems again. So the opposition will start rising, and that's where they will see real suppression. This is no prophecy. As a security analyst, I've seen this happening. Sorry about that. Yes, sorry. I think I'm talking too fast. Yes, so as a security analyst, I've read this over and over. It's in our history books, and there's something they say that history tells us that we don't learn from history. And this is a cycle. Over time, in Mali, we've seen it, where Mahmoud Diko, who had supported the removal of the civilian government, is currently calling for democracy and is now being chased away from his own country. The military is now against him. And the youth that are for him are now unflinchingly supporting him to return the country back to democracy. Now, Mali has severed ties with Algeria and ended the Algiers Accord. That was supposed to bring peace between the central government and the Tuaregs because of Malam Mahmoud Diko, who is calling for democracy. This man was hosted in Algiers, and that was an upset for the junta in Mali. It means now the youth that were supporting the junta in the street and hoisting Russian flags, and I mean, seeing them as the messianic interveners are currently found wanting. This is a cycle I don't need anybody to teach me about. It is so common. That is the situation. And as a security analyst, I'm concerned because whatever justification you give to post-colonial French, those diabolic policies, you cannot equate that to the denial of the people of the right to choose their own leaders. You cannot, no matter the situation. So if France did it and you've been able to push France away, when are you handing over? When are you? In fact, at best, at worst, you can decide to remove your fatigue and wear jacket, suit, to run for elections. At least the people have the right to choose their leaders. Don't use this excuse to entrench your power. And despite what sounds like I have a position on this, like, you know, when you listen to me, it's like, Fidel wants democracy. Fidel wants democracy. But the point is this. The point is this. This is what we have learned from history. It is always painful to watch history getting repeated and nobody learning from it. So that has been the case. And as a security analyst, I'm concerned because in the coming years, we will only be talking about how many civilians who are on the streets in these countries and the junta have used force to get them off the streets or killed or kidnapped or jailed. These are the things we'll be reporting. And when it happens, and I don't pray for that, but when it happens, kindly call me back so that we can revisit this discussion.
Speaking about that, I like that. I like that it will get to a point where the Kuntas will run out of excuse. They will run out of who to blame. And I've read some of your piece, and you've repeated it here as well. And I think, to be honest with you, in my recent book, one of the things that I keep saying to you that Africa, there are two demographics that will change Africa. the youth and women.
Yes.
Sometimes when I say that, people don't understand what I mean by that. So, but from what you're from, you expanding on that, it will come to a point where the Kuntans will run out of wood to play.
Yeah.
And then it will be them and the people. But what happens is, when that happens, let's pray that if that happens, there's going to be the international community, which you definitely involve. The West would have to exercise his responsibility to protect. Or not. How do you see that playing out if we ever get to that place? Do you see?
Yeah. You see, this is the unfortunate thing. After Libya, the R2P is generally weakened in Africa after Libya. Because when NATO intervened in Libya, they realized that they had opened a can of worms. And that was the fact that this is a dictator that has been in power for 40 years and has mastered the art of manipulating his own people in order to stay on. Then you go and remove him. So at that point, everybody feels that he could be a leader. And that is what has led to the division of Libya to today and the chaos that has followed. Now, in the case of Europe, the lesson is that, look, we got rid of Gaddafi and now migrants are reaching our shores every day without any bulwark to stop them. But Gaddafi used to manage them for us. So with those lessons learned, African populations may be suffering and the West could do nothing or may do nothing about it because of that lesson from Libya. We found Obama leaving office and saying that one of his foreign policy regrets was Libya. And so these are some of the things that what happened in Libya is actually going to make these leaders numb or Western leaders numb. And so if the populations are going to count on R2P, it will be unfortunate because it might not happen. And in what happened with ECOWAS, where ECOWAS threatened some intervention, and the backlash that came, ECOWAS may also end up being a toothless bulldog that may do nothing about populations that are being suppressed. And that is the misfortune. And in fact, it will be interesting to see how things go. But I know for a fact that the central element or factor in these relations, I mean, I don't think that we need Africa needs US bases to survive. No, I don't think so. There are instances where we can negotiate with rebels. There are instances that when we are able to coordinate with local and tribes leaders, we are able to fight terrorism better because these terrorists are found in populations within Africa. And so when you're able to bring all these guys on board or encourage inclusivity, you can fight terrorism. I believe in all this. But the issue is that the situation at stake, you are getting rid of them. That is fine. What next? That is what I'm concerned about.
That could, to be honest, that could, we also have to look at the positive side of it. That could also spark a homegrown, when you're pushed to the wall and you look back and you look, you know, if that could push for a homegrown where African people, the populace take charge and understand that, you know, there's nowhere to run to. We need to fight for our freedom or for what we deserve. So that could
But unfortunately, in all this game, we are only pushing away one to supplant it with another. That is the thing. Yes. So and it's so clear. So that is if these guys were getting rid of everyone and saying that we are going to take our destiny in our own hands, then you see that, well, maybe they are doing something.
Sorry to cut you short. Speaking of that, I was speaking with an MP in Congo, DRC. was in a podcast a couple of episodes ago, and I was talking to him about the mining and then China, because in DRC you see where China dominates the mining industry, the mining, and then you see that same thing you were talking about, this great power competition, and like Riley said, they are all for their own strategic interests.
Yes.
And but it's something she clearly said when she was highlighting African agencies, and then talking about we can make our own decisions, like whether China provides a better option or better stuff than the West. As I said, that's my understanding from the way she was saying it. So whereas it could be a question of like the which is the lesser devil. I've just seen the argument because at the end of the day, Africa seems to be, we're torn between, Africa is torn between choosing the lesser devil. We can say, okay, these people have, I'm just analyzing.
Yeah.
We've been raped for many years. You know, France has, raped this continent or this section of them for many years. And, like Riley said, what should we?
Yeah.
If you understand what I'm saying? So,
I understand. But you see, the problem is that even for China, that's engaged in the doling out of loans, it is currently beaten back. I mean, trying to backpedal in that it means that Africans are unable to pay back these loans. And so the volume of loans and even investment per current reports is going down. That is a matter of fact. So I keep saying that there's no free lunch anywhere around the world. There's no free lunch. So if you call someone, you are giving a person free lunch, you are going to discuss something that is of mutual benefit or maybe benefit you over him or him over something. However, Africa must set its priorities right, especially continental cohesion. I was in the university when EPA, there was so much noise about EPA, Economic Partnership Agreement from EU. And one day I confronted the EU representatives in Ghana that, look, stop this. What is Ghana producing that you want to engage in free trade with us? What is Ghana producing? You want to turn Ghana into a dumping ground for your goods? And that was my honest, and it has not changed. That if you really and truly want the interest of Africa, why don't you sign this with us en bloc? So that at least our production capacity in South Africa, Egypt, Nigeria, and some emerging economies on the continent could be used as a front to really compete with you until such time that the smaller ones get along. So these are the things. But when people say, well, we have to get rid of these guys are the good guys, and I don't know what the definition of good is. And after all, when I'm supposed to choose between the two evils, I always choose that allows me to express myself. If I'm supposed to choose between two systems, currently I have three kids. And if I'm living the world today, I'll let them to live in a free society, a society where they can express themselves. I don't want a society where when they move to the street, they want to, demonstrate against something, they will be shot and killed. This is rational for every human being. You know? So this is something that we have to look at. And sometimes, the truth is so painful that some people, it distorts people's illusions. And so people, try to be dodgy with it. But that is the fact. We cannot pretend that there is a particular actor, global actor, that wants the interest of Africa above itself. No.
Speaking of continental bloc, we've had Riley mentioned about ECOWAS. And ECO was trying to pull his weight with this Niger thing, so this is how I want to take this. This is how I want to pose this question. I'm going to place in different layers. So first, we talked about the French colony, and how you were telling me how the former French colonies adopted French constitutions. Letter instead of like extricating themselves from them. Now we've seen where in AU or in Africa where the AU or the African countries are defending the inherited borders which is quite ironic, number one. Then two, we've seen I brought a brigadier general from Nigeria last time to talk about ECOWAS, and he said something quite striking. He said ECOWAS initial sanctions were motivated by the promise or the whatever of funding from EU, where they had to deal with ECOWAS as a bloc, and with this free three contenders leaving and forming an alliance, it threatens that bloc. But it's quite interesting. You've mentioned that the relevance of the bloc. Relevance. So you have the ACFTA and have the AU Agenda 2063. How does Africa strengthen these positions and use it? You know, because, you know, to be honest, I'm tired of hearing Russia, these, like Riley said, nobody's going to prioritize your interests over their interests. There's always strategic interests. So how does Africa itself, you know, maintain its priority and say, okay, this is my priority, this is how I want to deal as a collective? How does all these ECOWAS, SODOC, and all these, you know, several, how do we use them? How when would they become that channel to either facilitate African security or African development?
Firstly, our generals have helped protect us for a long time, so I always give them respect. And sometimes they may be privy to very superior information that we may not be privy to. But let's assume that what the general said is true. Maybe because of some funding from Europe, ECOWAS was supposed to exercise some machismo and so sanction or threaten intervention. But the question is this. Was it the first time ECOWAS did that? No. It happened in Liberia. It happened in Gambia. And the Gambia was 2017. So this is no novel. It was not unique to Niger. That is one. So precedence is very important in the international affairs. Precedence. Another one is this. So the ECOWAS protocol that calls for sanctions for states that has had forceful take of power or the use of force to take power. What were we going to do about it without AU or EU funding or EU promise of funding or whatever? We had that in our books. Unless we want to say that we need people to give us money in order to implement our own rules that we've made. Or we would like to suggest that we made those protocols because someone funded us to make them. It wasn't original. Then we can start another agreement. So that is something that we have to pay, we discuss another time. But with continental protocols or regimes that have emerged, AU, from OAU to AU, the African Continental Free Trade Agreement or area, you look at all these and you realize that we are on a forward march. No matter how incremental that we may be, we are on a forward march. But with the current happenings, how do you move ahead? For instance, the Ezuwini consensus. Africans met and said that, look, now we want democracy. Henceforth, look, at that time, we had leaders like Gaddafi and others in power, and they all agreed that we will not support the use of force to take power at the time. So the Ezuwini consensus by AU, which was also embedded in the UN system, was done to make sure that Africa has chosen the path of democracy or to democracy. And we don't want to go back because in the 80s, the 70s, the coups did not help us. What did coups do to Nigeria? What did they do? From 99 to date, Nigeria has not been a perfect state. But from 99 to date, we've seen some astronomical development. Nigeria became the largest economy in Africa under civilian rule. Yes, and that is a fact we cannot run away from. In those days when we had so many coups, South Africa with a smaller population and but a better industry was ahead. But currently, because of some liberal investments flowing in, because the person knows that if someone is trying to, when I come to Nigeria, nobody can use a military decree to take over my investment. So the investment will come in. Nigerians abroad are coming back to reinvest in their homes. And you and I know. In other countries, this are happening. And you see, funnily enough, such an insecure country like Somalia even has its citizens abroad coming back home in that risk to establish something. So there is a need for us to know where we want to go. We should not allow this new Cold War, so to speak, to divide us once again. In the name of Russia is superior, that guy is inferior, that guy is that. No. Whatever that is happening in Francophone Africa, as I said, is something I've written about even before this coup started. That, look, France cannot continue to keep a country's foreign reserves or central, be the central bank or host the central bank of African countries. It's meaningless. So the situation is happening, but where do we go from here? Are we going back to the coup days where somebody in fatigue comes and then he's the master of all, he surveys, and over in the long term try to create some kind of dynasty for himself, let his children come after him? Can't my children also aspire to be leaders? These are the things the youth must be thinking about. These are the things the youth must be thinking about. And someone may ask, I was in Togo last year in the Lomé Security Conference, and I heard people saying, oh, maybe democracy is not even good for Africa. Why are we talking about democracy? Oh, democracy may not be good. Then when you ask them, what is the alternative? They are refusing to answer. They don't really give an alternative. And the question is, if you don't have an alternative, why is democracy bad? But Doc, you know that every African country is made up of multi-ethnic. Which ethnicity should be allowed to rule forever? And for who to wait? No. Allow them, put democracy there. People will make their choices over time. Look, in Niger, the president that was deposed was from a minority group, the Diffa, from Southeast. In a dictatorship, the Diffa would never have a chance to ever be in charge of Niger. But because of democracy and alliances, you know, you find ethnicities forming alliances in order to get leadership.
So Rita Abrahamson, she's a scholar. I think she's based in Canada. She used to be based there. In 2000, she wrote this article, say, Return of the Generals. And now we've seen some sort of, where we've seen across mostly the former French colonies, you've seen, you know, coup d'etat. And in other places where you start seeing the last decade, you see where they take over and then they start planning transitions. And people are saying, oh, the kuntas of this era is different from the Kodo because, you know, they're giving back power. But now, from your analysis and what we're seeing, they are trying to solidify power and not give back power. So what would you say moving forward? I've asked people about Nigeria. They say, well, Nigeria now could cannot happen. But I think I've seen you written something. I think I saw something you've written. I don't know. So do you think this is a trend moving forward? Or what do you see moving forward?
Okay. Thank you very much. My article today was on the Niger Delta issue, where some 16 uniformed men have been killed while intervening in an intercommunity clashes in the South Delta State. Now, my point was not that it's going to lead to a coup. My point was that given the excuses or the pretext, or let me use my words carefully, the reasons the military has given, or militaries across the Sahel have given for their takeovers, we have to treat those military civilian clashes carefully so that one day somebody doesn't get up and say, well, we are not even secure. There's so much insecurity that even the military is attacked. And so we are justified to come back and ensure security. I mean, we've seen it happened in Mali, it happened in Burkina Faso, and it happened in Niger. Now, one thing is that in analysis, you always use the past, the present, and what's likely to happen in the future. Is Nigeria new to coup d'etat? No, it is not. So that is a possibility. Not a probability, but a possibility. And so you treat these issues with meticulous attention, give it meticulous attention so that it does not lead to something we don't want. And I mentioned that a coup in Nigeria or a military takeover in Nigeria will be worse than what we are experiencing in the Sahel, because Nigeria will prove to be more consequential than all other places or all other countries. So in the region, because it's the largest economy, largest, the most populated country, and the largest growing democracy we have on the continent. The last election, we all sat on tenterhooks because we wanted a smooth transition. And fortunately for us, it happened despite the courts and all that, which is part of the electoral process, by the way. So that is very important. Again, there are some countries that have proven to be stronger. And even these countries are not, I mean, we cannot guarantee anything for them. That is Ghana, Senegal. And Senegal, we see what is happening, where the leader is leaving and wants someone he can agree with to stay and all that. Very funny. It shouldn't happen. It should not happen. If Sonko is a socialist and will become a socialist, so be it. What is politics about if people don't have ideologies? People are on the different spectrum. You have somebody who believes in the leftist idea coming, another one from the right will come. I don't believe in Sonko will be more closer to Russia, so I don't believe in those stuff. As long as domestically there's democracy, such relationship could be regulated. So these are the things. So in the case, and I mentioned in my article, the two turnover tests, where party A wins power and hands over to party B, and then party B handing back power to party A. Nigeria has not achieved that. Ghana has. Because since 1999, we've only had two political parties ruling Nigeria. And one lost power and handed over to the PDP, to the APC. It has not gone back to any other party. It means that it is not stable, too stable yet. And the two turnover test is a measure of democratic stability. Nigeria is not there. We are only hopeful that it gets there. So you take Liberia just achieved that in the last elections. Even though Nigeria has started the democratic system for a longer time, longer than Liberia, Liberia has achieved that stability. You know, so this is to say that I'm not trying to say that because of the coup in the Sahel, every other country is going to experience a coup. What I'm trying to say is that we have to be proactive to avoid, because the propaganda is so much. Look, I talk to youth and sometimes, I mean, it's just pathetic, I would say, because so the thing they say, it can't be backed by any evidence. I mean, this is that. I mean, past comment, and somebody will say, well, we wish the military comes back, and they don't have any experience with that. They don't know what it means when the constitution is suspended. They know that it affects how you speak, how you can demonstrate, and everything. They don't know that. You know, so these are the things that we have to pay attention to. You have to be meticulous, be more proactive. For instance, in Nigeria, these communal clashes should be handled at the state and the federal level, I mean, proactively, before they lead to Merkaba clashes. For the military to step in. Again, the military, we should have a force, the police force, a specialized police force that deals with domestic issues. The military is not responsible for domestic issues. I mean, technically, the military is supposed to be there to, fend off external aggression. The military is not supposed to be, separating domestic fights, community fights. No. When that happens, it leads to what we call institutional disrespect and disdain on the part of the public. And over time, it erodes the credibility of an institution that is supposed to be, treated with care. That's very important.
Listen, Fidel, you've provided a very deep, objective assessment of the situation, and even broader to tell us, you know, projection of what could happen in situ and what we can do to tame this. We're so grateful to have you come on board, and we definitely optimistic and hopeful, and that, you know, the continent we're not decided into that kind of chaos. Like you said, we'll call you back then. So we'll call you back for more positive to come.
You know, when you call me back, when you call me back, I am anticipating a progressive or an advanced Africa, a continent that is removing barrier to trade, for us to trade among ourselves, that I can, please, which country are you based in currently?
United Kingdom.
Oh, well, so, but you are from Nigeria?
Yes.
So I should, if I should be able to apply for a job in Lagos, if I see vacancy, I should do that. Mm-hmm. And someone in Lagos should be able to do that in Accra and do that in Kampala and Nairobi. And with that, that is my what I anticipate, the positives and how we can progress ourselves, define our path and seek the partners. We cannot do it alone. We always need partners and get very constructive partners that and have win-win games and win-win relationship with these partners in order for Africa to progress. And that is what I'm expecting. But for what we see in the Sahel, I'm afraid it's not too positive.
I'll stop on that note and stay on the first side of your share your optimism. But I also understand that with the current situation it looks bleak. But I'll share your optimism and hopefully we'll get it. But once again, we'll thank you. We're grateful. This episode will be out next week, and we would share with you, and we would employ you to help us share it as well with the next as well. So thank you very much. We'll hopefully see you one day soon again.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you for tuning in today. We're grateful to our guest, Fidel Owusu, for providing such deep insights into the current situation happening in Niger. I'll employ you to subscribe to our channels, our YouTube channel, Spotify channel, for more updates. And stay tuned, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.